Hello and welcome to the Sobremesa podcast with me, your host, Alan Maguire. Today is Monday the 26th of October. Today I have an incredibly interesting interview for you with Sophie Gonick. She's a professor at New York University and she's written a book on social platforms that really emerged around the 2008-2010 crisis to stop evictions in Spain during the housing crisis or the collapse of the housing boom. And she tells the untold origins of this, that the other side of the story that isn't related to Aduca Lau, the mayor of Barcelona. That's often the popular story that's told. But there's actually a much deeper and a very interesting story to this, these platforms. She also talks about the culture of housing in Spain. So, and also why Spain really does lack social housing in a form that many other countries do have. I hope you enjoy the interview. Today I have Sophie Gonick with me on Sobremesa. Welcome to Sobremesa, Sophie. She is the author of the forthcoming book, Dispossession and Descent, Immigrants and the Struggle for Housing in Madrid, which will be published with Stanford University Press. Welcome, Sophie. How are you?
I'm good. Here in New York City.
Welcome. So, Sophie, I saw your book title on Twitter, and it sounds absolutely fascinating. There's this, you know, this is an issue in Madrid. I live in Leganés, and I mean, we've got housing issues here, but you know, in the centre, it's even worse. So it's something I see every day. So it's a pleasure to interview you and find out more about the work you've been doing around this. So how did the book come about? And you know, can you give us a bit of an impression about, you know, your time in Madrid and what you saw, and you know, how it led up to this, the publication of this book?
Sure. Well, I've lived in Madrid in a lot of different, under a lot of different guises, I would say, as like, you know, an American university student and as a immediate post-grad and having my kind of typical party experience of the city as a young person. And then yeah. I kind of transitioned into my new academic life. And so did research in the city in various different points. The bulk of the research for the book comes from 2013, 2014, when a lot of the social movement activity around housing was really kind of at its peak. Uh-huh. And the book really responds in part to my experiences living there in the city during the kind of golden days of the boom between 2003 and 2008, uh-huh. when I observed, first of all, this kind of tremendous demographic transition that the country was making and also the city, in which Spain went from having very little immigration and like under a million immigrants living in the whole of the country in the late 90s to being very much an immigrant country, and you know, where there's like 6 million immigrants by the end of that, of the kind of the boom years. Uh-huh. And so observing this kind of just the marked diversity of everyday urban life, and then alongside it also this kind of tremendous construction activity when Madrid was constructing, you know, vast amounts of new housing, new towers. They were doing the Madrid Rio project. All of this is going on, transforming the kind of everyday experience of the city.
Yeah.
I was curious as to how immigrants were navigating this city, as well as how, most particularly, how they were navigating housing, because I could tell it was just getting more and more expensive.
And the cost of housing or the rent or?
The cost of housing.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, I was renting, but it was in a period of time when the rental market was really small and very unregulated. It didn't, you were left kind of to the whims of landlords, which for the most part is still the case.
Yeah.
And really, like, everybody lived in owner-occupied housing. Everybody was buying a house.
And is this like the time, you know, before 2010 when, you know, people were getting second houses and second mortgages and they were... And I read somewhere they're like, the immigrants that were coming were like feeding partly the housing boom, because they were like, more people are coming, so we need to build more houses. Is that how true that simplified version is? Or
yeah, I mean, so immigrant arrivals were certainly a statistic that was deployed to justify the creation of more housing.
Uh-huh.
In the late 90s, when Madrid is debating the creation of a new master plan for the city,
uh-huh.
they talk extensively about the need for more housing units. And they estimate that the city needs between 120 and 170,000 new housing units in that period of time. But in the plan that they pass, they leave aside room and designate land for about 300,000 new housing units. And they justify that by signaling this kind of anticipation of immigration.
Okay.
But that's still hugely inflated, you know, to think that you need maybe 150,000 housing units and instead plan for twice that amount is somewhat suspect.
Yeah.
And of course, in a moment in which towns such as Leganés and all throughout the region are also creating plans to build a whole hell of a lot of new housing.
Yeah.
And practically all of it is housing that's meant for homeownership. That's not going to be rental stock. It's not going to be what we would traditionally think of as public housing.
Uh-huh.
That which is actually kind of social housing, a la Española, if you want to say it, is very much, for the most part, is rent to own and subsidized mortgages. It's not it's not like British council housing or American housing projects or you know, the French banlieue, for example.
Yeah. And so I suppose like 2010 comes, the immigration, like, what was their experience up till 2010? Sorry, you said you were like observing their path.
Yeah. Well, so I didn't know, right? I was just living there and I had my own housing struggles and, and I saw other people having housing struggles and yet there was, you know, a real estate agency on every block, if not two. And I know I knew a lot of people who were working for Tecnocasa in that moment. And selling houses, and they were in fact selling a lot of houses to immigrants. But it wasn't until 2012 when I came back to do research. Actually, that's not true. It's in 2011, and I'm there in June, and it's the occupation of Seoul from the 15M movement has been ongoing for about a month.
Right.
And it's when activists decide to block an eviction in Madrid. This is the first eviction that's blocked in the city of Madrid, while there have been other stop desahucios, or, you know, the blocking of evictions in other parts of the country. And I read this in El País one morning, and the eviction that was supposed to take place, the homeowners were, one was a Lebanese man, and he was married to a Ukrainian or a Bulgarian woman.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought this was very interesting, that there's this kind of outpouring of activist support for immigrant homeowners.
Uh-huh.
And so that kind of began my foray into this, in understanding what was going on.
Uh-huh.
And when I came back in 2012 to do a more extensive period of research, I discovered that, in fact, the platform for people affected by mortgages, which is the kind of social movement collective that has fought off a lot of these evictions throughout Spain, and has become very well known, was actually filled with immigrants. And so I was wondering why and how these people got mortgages. And what it turned out was that, first of all, many of them also experienced tremendous housing difficulties. The rental market was incredibly discriminatory towards them. If if there's no legal protections for marginalized groups of society, there's a landlord can ask for, say, 6 months of rent as a deposit, which for a laborer you probably can't pay, or if you're a university professor, you probably can't pay. And often found when the search for their housing units, they were redirected to the home ownership market. And of course, it was a moment in which loans were extremely easy to get. I mean, they were being handed out like candy to children for Halloween, right? It was like everywhere you went, somebody wanted to offer you credit to buy a house, to buy a new car, to buy a new set of furniture. And so many immigrants entered into the home ownership market because it was a means of finding housing. And then they also had, the aspirations of kind of upward mobility and, kind of saving through the vehicle of the home that we think about traditionally in relation to private property.
So where did so the platforms against eviction, did you were you involved, and did you like what did you observe about their development? Because I mean they're like legendary here now. I mean, I think Ada Colau, who's like mayor of Barcelona, she was like
She was a spokesperson,
she was a spokesperson for one, and but even like Irene Montero, who's now like the minister for equality, I think she was in one as well.
Yeah, I know her from
Oh, okay.
being in many an assembly with her, but so I spent over a year kind of working in the trenches with this group,
Wow, cool.
and going, every day practically to mortgage counseling sessions, to assemblies, to demonstrations and protests, to evictions and to courthouses and all of the work that they participated in. The story I tell in my book actually is the immigrant history of this very important platform. And it's a story that really hasn't been told. The story of Ada Colau is one that has kind of inspired, many activists and the working class, and is a really, really interesting and wonderful story. But on the other hand, even before she was organizing around the question of evictions, a small group of Ecuadorian migrants in Madrid had begun to get organized because they were facing housing dispossession. These are people who had bought into the housing market because, to secure a home. Often their loans were for in the hundreds of thousands of euros. They were on for properties that were extremely overvalued. And there's been a lot of stuff written about the collusion that was existed between like appraisers, the notary publics, and lawyers and the real estate industry in this moment, such that, a house that was really only worth maybe 180,000 euros would be inflated to 300,000 euros. And of course, immigrants in a crisis, in an economic crisis, are often the first to lose their jobs. They're precariously employed as subcontracted laborers or as live-in help or as, janitors and house cleaners. And so if, once the economy contracts, they're often the most expendable. And so because they were the first to lose their jobs, they were also the first to, experience an inability to pay for their mortgage. And so then what happens, obviously, the mortgage enters into arrears. And what a lot of people didn't realize in this moment was that once your house gets repossessed by the bank and you're kicked out, you're actually left with a whole hell of a lot of the outstanding debt on it. So people were finding that they were being kicked out of their houses, they didn't have any money left, and they were being left with like 100,000 euros worth of debt that would go with them to their grave.
Jesus.
And so in light of this, this group of Ecuadorian women and men, but a lot of them are women, begin to organize around what to do. And, you know, the story I tell is, you know, there's a woman, Aida Quinatoa, who's was at that point the president of the of one of the largest Ecuadorian associations in the city. Mm-hmm. She was also a homeowner and a house cleaner. And she'd come out of the indigenous movement in Ecuador before she moved to Spain. And so she, you know, she's really a catalyzing figure who draws upon her own experience as an activist. And told me in interviews, you know, I've never seen a place on earth where if you get organized, that, you know, it doesn't work. You have to get organized and you have to be a lot of people.
Yeah.
And to affect change. And so she, you know, cognizant of her own mortgage problems, she begins talking to people within her community and they begin to organize. And the first protest against evictions, against mortgage related evictions, excuse me, happens in Madrid in December of 2008. This is well before we know anything about the PA, the platform, anything about Ada Colau. It's December 20th, 2008, and this group of, you know, maybe 100 Ecuadorian men and women march from the judicial courts in the north to the Bank of Spain in the south, and to demand, demand action on this particular situation. Of course, it's a moment in which they're mostly alone and experiencing this problem. A few members of the working class might have also been in similar situations, but it wasn't then kind of the social pandemic, to use a timely word, that it would become several years later.
Wow.
So the book charts their kind of experience and shows first why they were buying into home ownership and then what happens when it all falls apart.
And did they sort of, because you said like that was 2008, the Ecuadorians were already organizing. Did they sort of merge with the 15M movement, and, you know, did they work together or was it separate? And you know, what was their relationship with the Spanish?
So they, you know, they continued to organize, and at a certain point they got involved with a group that was a working class community in Meco, which is, you know, a far-flung suburb of Madrid. And they also worked with the FRAM, the Federación Regional de Asociaciones de Vecinos de Madrid, the Regional Federation of Neighborhood Associations. And so they were kind of working together on these various political projects. And at a certain point, you know, the PA had emerged, and at a certain point they decided to kind of become the PA Madrid, right? And then, but that's before 15M, and then 15M really brings all of this kind of, all of the social misery really of the crisis out into the open, and that's when they suddenly, there's like an outpouring of support and of cases and of, you know, people going and needing help to prevent eviction. And so the, you know, they work in some ways symbiotically, but also, you know, 15M kind of provides this enormous push, right? And of course, things are not always so beautiful and cooperative. There are any number of different tensions, competing activisms and styles of organizing. Both within the platform and, you know, between various platforms under the larger umbrella and between various different kind of groups in the city. But one of the things that the platform did in Madrid that really was unique to the Madrid case was that they worked with a lot of the 15M neighborhood groups. And so that there was a kind of back and forth between what was happening in the neighborhood and then what would be happening kind of at the central centralized platform, such that they were kind of feeding one another. And,
right. Well, and so did they, would they like, because I don't, for any listeners that, that haven't heard of these platforms, they're famous for sort of literally going to the door of the house that the person's been evicted from and, you know, stopping people from entering, aren't they? Is that something that they started or?
So that, I can't remember entirely who starts doing that, because it started, I think it started in Malaga or in or in Murcia, and then it becomes adopted by Barcelona, and that's what really makes it famous. And then in Madrid, you had a lot of people working who were who advocated for going kind of more legal legal channels. And that's where, like, Rafael Mayoral, who's now minister of something with Podemos, was the legal architect of a lot of the platform's judicial strategies. And but one of the things that I write about in the book, in the last chapter, is the ways in which, in part, like, all of these different forms of activism, like, whether it's filing lawsuits and going to the court or taking the streets or blocking an eviction or occupying an empty building en masse, allows for a lot of different people to take part, right? If you are more partial to one kind of style of doing things, it's there for you. But if you're more partial to another, say, you know, you aren't that into occupying a building late at night in the cover of darkness, the threat of arrest, but you do want to help, you know, counsel people going through, you know, financial collapse, there's something there for you. So it receives this kind of outpouring of sympathy and support, but it also is attractive to a lot of different people who are kind of wondering what to do about, you know, protesting austerity and the terrible conditions of the Spanish crisis.
It seems to be like, I mean, obviously it's a good platform in itself as well, but it also seems to have been a, like the origin of, you know, breaking the mold that is the two-party system in Spain. You know, you got the PSOE and the PP at the time, really the only difference, some might say, was the colour of their ties, you know, very much plastic mould of the politician. And, you know, I think the 15M obviously was a big part of it, but a lot of the politicians that are most of them are associated to Podemos, but they're also part of other, you know, different platforms in local governments. But it seems like they got a lot of experience of organisation and probably, you know, pushed into politics because of this.
So I've actually also written a lot about the municipalist projects that I'm, which are the citizens' platforms that emerge to run for city halls across Spain. And, you know, they've been in power now in Barcelona. This is the second mayoral term of Ada Colau. Manuela Carmena in Madrid was also somebody who came out of this, or her candidacy came out of this effort. And I think, so I wrote an article that came out now several years ago, kind of trying to understand where the impulse to move into electoral politics came from. And I think part of it was a frustration with the limit, like constantly coming up against institutional limits that were just so arbitrary. And wanting to push for change, that, and being aware that some of the change had to come from within the institutions themselves. But I also think that 15M and the kinds of activisms that occurred afterwards really revealed the fact that politics isn't just about who wins elections and who's sitting in the Congreso de Diputados or in Moncloa. It's what happens in the street. It's what happens in the neighborhood. It's about how we live together, how we interact with one another, how we kind of imagine our urban community to be and to look like, and that to do politics, one had to engage in a lot of different spaces, right? You had to be in the street, you had to be in the assembly, and then you also maybe had to run for city hall, and there's no perfect recipe, right? Now that some of these projects have been in city halls, they also now see the limits of institutional
power. It's like the mirror effect, sort of. You know, you see both sides of the coin, really. I mean, the other, we're talking about like the state and the limitations and things. I think I don't really know a lot about it, but coming from the UK, where historically up until like the early 90s, we had a lot of council housing. There was no shame in living in a council house. People were very proud of it. And then, you know, we had Margaret Thatcher selling off all the council houses. And it, when I was growing up, it was sort of, it started to get a bad name, and, you know, councils weren't, they were maintaining them to a degree, but they weren't building new housing and things. And I think that's like a common story across much of Europe. But Spain in itself is quite, has a different approach, doesn't it, to social housing? I don't know.
Well, so, wow, this is a big topic. I'm a former historian, and so I had to go deep into the archives to trace the kind of origin of contemporary housing policy in Spain, which emerges under Franco, who is actually at the very beginning of the Franco dictatorship. The Falange, his fascist group, is actually really in favor of what we would think of as social housing, of like giving poor people housing, because they see it as a way of inspiring loyalty to the regime and of carrying out their kind of Catholic duty. But what happens is they have no money, right? Franco, Spain has absolutely no money after the Civil War. Mm. Everything's in ruins. The rest of the world is engaged in World War II. And so they're like, how the hell do we get any money? And what they decide at some point is that really construction is, you know, you don't need outside, you know, aid or goods or, you know, materials to pursue construction. And so, and part of that is like, okay, we're going to construct houses because we also have a housing shortage. And so we're going to construct houses, but to make it, you know, worth our while, they need to be purchased then. And they need to be purchased by homeowners. And so you see that in the 40s, the emergence of the home ownership model that comes to like dominate so much of urban and also social policy throughout the last, you know, almost 100 years. And so in the same moment, they do a lot of work to discourage renting, and it's where some of the urban myths around renting in Spain come out of this moment of, it's like throwing money away, it's, you know, and you can't rent out your house, people are just going to ruin it. And so there's all of this effort to make Spain into a homeownership nation as a means of both. I mean, some of it is a means of social control through, you know, and capitalist growth through the figure of the homeowner. And then some of it's also just to create a robust construction industry. What happens then is that, you know, a lot of the events of this book take place in the last, you know, from about 2000 to, you know, 2012, say.
Yeah.
And what happens when you there when Spain and particularly Madrid is faced with this huge influx of immigrants and they don't really know what to do and they're kind of scrambling around to create any kind of like intercultural programming and policy. Real estate and finance capital are there to offer home ownership. And so home ownership becomes in that moment very much a kind of de facto integration policy, such that, you know, I mean, and also like in a nation that is severely divided by regional particularities, there is nothing more Spanish than owning your own home. At this point, in the early 2000s, about, you know, something like between 80 and 90% of people lived in owner-occupied housing. And so immigrants are are taking part in this very, very Spanish tradition that nonetheless emerges from a, you know, specific policies that were developed under Franco. So I can't actually remember what your question was, but
no, that was interesting.
Council housing.
About state housing. I mean,
and so you know, everything, there's just has always been this very small, or always since the beginning of the major construction of housing under Franco, there's just been way more energy directed towards creating owner-occupied housing. What is then created for social housing is, as I said, like, subsidized mortgages for lower income people, or rent to own, or, you know, a variety of different programs, such that, you know, the working class can also access home ownership. And then what they have of the kind of traditional, very, very low rent social housing that we think of, say, in relation to Britain, is like a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the housing stock.
It's I mean, I've barely seen any like that you would be able to identify. I mean, you know, I'm living in a place that I'm married to someone that's been here her whole life, so she knows the certain areas. But there's hardly any. I mean, it's really, really strange. And it makes me wonder, like, what happened to many of the immigrants that lost their jobs and lost their... Because, I mean, there's the... My understanding of Spanish immigration is that it boomed under the housing boom, and then it crashed. You know, people basically went home. Like, people left Spain, and Spaniards left, or did they not?
I don't think that they... So, yes, a lot of people left, but a lot of people stayed. A lot of people, and I think it was, you know, particular to every individual case of whether you, I mean, a lot of people who'd been here, in New York, a lot of people who'd been there had, you know, gotten papers under the amnesties that the Zapatero government established. And many of them then gained nationality. And so, and like had kids and started families too. And so you saw just different trajectories. And the people who stayed also lived through the same crisis that, you know, everybody else was going through.
They must have struggled quite a bit, like being like first generation. I mean, one of, so coronavirus can't help but not mention, but, you know, Pedro Sanchez in his speech when they announced the state of alarm, I think it was like March 13th or something like that. And he said, you know, the elderly have looked after us. They took us into their homes and, you know, they gave us part of their pensions when we were all unemployed and, you know, in the financial crisis. But like immigrants didn't have access to family, you know, family like that.
No, they didn't have access to families like that. And something that I also write about in the book, the ways in which, like, various strategies of just survival and the kind of support networks that people drew upon. But, you know, immigrants in many ways were also, are also extremely resilient. They'd come in with practically nothing and, you know, had lived often in situations of overcrowding before. And actually I have, you know, somebody was described to me like, you arrived, you probably shared a room with maybe your whole family, and then you maybe were able to go move on to another shared flat where you got your own room, and then, you know, maybe after a while you got your own flat for your family, and then, you know, later down the line maybe you bought something. But so they, you know, they were incredibly resourceful, and you find ways of getting by, whether it's through, because of the work of the platform, many were able to stay on in their homes in some capacity, often at reduced, very, very reduced rents. And here's actually one of the, I mean, while Spain doesn't have this kind of social housing mandate that exists in other parts of the world, what happened was that banks were left with so much housing stock, and they make terrible landlords, by the way, that they would, they often were then providing basically the equivalent of social housing to their former clients, renting at very, very, very reduced monthly prices to people who'd been, you know, who'd previously been homeowners. And so, you know, through one way or another, people kind of hold on and find work where they can, and find, you know, also support from family, support from friends. You know, the Ecuadorian community that I've worked with is extremely close-knit and organized. They have a number of different associations. They are, you know, have Ecuadorian businesses throughout the city, and have a lot of social life. And so, you know, through kind of communal work and mutual aid, right? A lot of the neighborhood groups that emerged out of 15M were very involved in mutual aid networks, which then, you know, are also re-emerging now that we're experiencing the pandemic. And a lot of these communities, you know, are both once again facing extreme hardship, but also have this kind of previous experience of working together to kind of stave off complete disaster, such that, you know, like, activist tradition kind of could come and reemerge in interesting different ways, right?
It's you know, it's something that, I mean, the Madrid community government that's meant to be managing this crisis has really done next to nothing. Most of the stories that I've seen relating to people that are in hardship have been through, you know, volunteer platforms, or whether they're brand new, or, but I'm sure people that set them up, you know, probably have some experience back during the financial crisis.
And there was really always this an ethos of like solidarity and sharing, and so part of what I'm talking about in the book is the way in which this moment actually creates what homeownership policy couldn't do, which was new communities with, you know, cooperation between very diverse groups, and people learning from, you know, native Spaniards were learning from immigrants and vice versa. And so, you know, that the memories of the crisis, I mean, the crisis was only, for a lot of people, never ended, first of all. For whom their situations improved, it's still like not, it's not a distant memory. It's pretty immediate.
And I just wondered if you could tell us, you know, when your book is due, where people will be able to get it from, and I'll put links to your articles on my website as well.
So my book is due to come out in late April, is preliminary, the April 27th. And you can order it, probably the easiest for international audiences is online via Amazon, though you will probably be able to order it from the Stanford University Press's website. And yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Sophie, I think is my Twitter handle. I don't know, I've been changing it around lately.
I'll pop a link on it, yeah.
And yeah.
Thank you for coming on. And
thank you for having me.
I think we'll probably see a lot more platforms. You know, these platforms, a couple of weeks ago, there was an 84-year-old guy being kicked out of his flat in Lavapierre's. I think he'd been there for 40 years and had terminal cancer. And, you know, the platform was out the front. And it's good, and it's good to hear how these platforms come about and that they do other work. You know, the you see the very spectacle sort of going out at 4 a.m. in the morning in the dark. But, you know, and how it's so integrated with you know, like the Podemos movements and 15M and how that, that legacy lives on and probably has probably benefited a lot of people during the coronavirus as well.
Yeah, and I will say, I mean, part of this is that a lot of the state, particularly in Madrid, has really like abrogated its role in providing social services for a large section of the population. And part of this is that, you know, anti-immigrant sentiment, as much as it whips up voters to go vote for you, it also is, doesn't really make for very good policymaking because it, you know, it so tinges everything with this kind of ideological quest to exclude that you end up really damaging your own, I think.
And privatizing everything. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
We've seen the great job that they've done all over the world. Private companies have tried to do managing phone application tracking services and things. And, you know, it is ideological in the sense that, you know, they want to privatize bloody everything.
Well, let me tell you, I am apparently led by a businessman in chief, and it's a fucking disaster, if I can say that. So, you know.
Thanks again, Sophie, for coming on the podcast. And you'll be happy to know that the platforms regarding housing haven't been as needed as much. So there are obviously still problems with housing. Normally, regional governments deal with housing with regards to providing it. But also, the national government has passed laws to place barriers around different types of eviction. So eviction can only be carried out if there's the family or the people have another place to go. And this is a there's a whole raft of other measures that the coalition government have passed since this interview. However, that doesn't mean that all of the Spaniards and everybody's housing problems in Spain are sorted with this current coronavirus pandemic. So it's certainly an area that I hope this podcast can continue to keep an eye on and get many more people that are involved around struggles with housing, but also support networks and mutual aid schemes is another thing I want to explore on this podcast. So if you know anyone or you are interested in that and would like to come on the podcast, please do get in touch with or via the email the.sobremesa.podcast@gmail.com. This week has been quite a historic one in Spanish politics. So Vox brought forward a motion of no confidence. They've been promising this for the last 2 months. They've kind of failed to build up any support for it. They said they were initially they were going to propose an independent candidate and that they were going to form an independent government, like a national coalition to try and get us through this crisis and then call elections. That kind of all fell away. And it was really just trying to find reasons to throw things at the central government. And in the end, Abascal ended up being the candidate. We saw 2 whole days worth of Congress speeches. It was a real waste of time. That every single MP or deputy in Spain was there. I mean, the amount of hours that they could have spent doing something more constructive is really, really quite astounding. Despite the length of the debates, it was all kind of very bad, really. I mean, the first day was Abascal basically slating the government, but not really saying what else they would do. And Pedro Sanchez decided to sort of take him head on. There was discussions within the government: should we ignore Vox or should we take them on? In the end, Sanchez ended up taking them on, which was, expected. And then the second day came, where it was Podemos and the PP's turn. Now everyone was very anxious about what the PP would do. The PP hadn't told anyone who they were going to vote for, whether they're going to abstain, whether they're going to vote with the Vox, or whether they were going to with vote against the government. Sorry, with the government against the motion of confidence. And many people were obviously awaiting Pablo Casado, the leader, speech. And after he gave his speech, he basically turned his back on Abascal. Abascal was caught a couple of days later saying that he felt the attack was personal. And Vox have actually came out of this really harmed. I think even in the most conservative media like ABC and, all these papers that have historically been very right-wing and pro-monarchist and pro-unified Spain, the motherland sort of papers, have even sort of shown that Vox are licking their wounds a bit after this. Pablo Casado gave a great speech. I mean, it was so great that afterwards Pablo Iglesias, on the other side of the ideological spectrum, said, that was a speech that was very good within the history, within the tradition of the right-wing Spanish intellectuals. And the PP voted with the government on the motion of no confidence. So the only people to vote for the motion of no confidence were the 52 Vox deputies. The thing that, and many people have echoed this, mainly on the left, but some in the centre, is that this is the Pablo Casado we needed. I've seen a few people say, but Pablo Iglesias went one step further and said, "Yeah, you're a bit late, as in, you should have said this years ago. You've been trying to catch up with the far right up until now, and that's." You've just like turned your back on them now. It's nice, but it's a bit late. And this really echoes what I think is going to be the next phase of politics in Spain, which is the split of the right. So the PP have effectively turned their back on Vox, but they rely on Vox's votes in many regions to pass laws. And the PP seem to be following Inés Arrimadas' move back to the centre with Ciudadanos. And even Ciudadanos said this week they won't be voting for any more historical memory bills brought forward by Vox regarding, the removing of names and statues in the Madrid region that were on the left side. So this is Vox using the historical memory law against the left. When many people normally see it as the other way around, they've sort of turned this thing around. So, that was one small split that we've seen so far. I think there's going to be very many more. In Vox, one of the sorry, in Andalusia, one of the Vox, I think it was the Vox spokesperson said, our votes don't come for free. So these regional governments and these town halls that Vox are in bed with Ciudadanos and the PP could really start to flare up. So let's see how things go there. Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. We will definitely keep you up to date with any changes here in the country with regards to coronavirus. But our focus on the next couple of weeks is going to be more so on interviews with about different cultural and societal aspects, but also about politics. I have a great show planned coming up for when the budget finally arrives. So Spain hasn't passed a budget in many, many years. And I'm hoping to have two guests on for a bit of a discussion around that. I'm also looking forward to interviewing several other people regarding Spanish politics and culture in the coming weeks, so you can expect to see plenty more interesting interviews on its way. I also have a crossover episode planned with another podcast that talks about Spain, and I hope to bring you that in the next couple of weeks, and I think that will also be quite fun to make. As ever, share and subscribe to this podcast. Make sure you share it with your friends and family. And don't forget to listen to our older episodes. I hope you have a great week. Thanks for listening.